Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Mark Twain spend his final years? While poor investment choices caused wild swings in Twain's financial security throughout much of his career, by the end of his life he was enjoying his hard-earned wealth and committed to ensuring his heirs would enjoy it after his death. Twain was also enjoying his fame. He was still writing, in high demand as a speaker, and was awarded an honorary degree from Oxford University in 1907. And he remained engaged in polishing his reputation, not only through the legendary characters he created in fiction, but as a raconteur. My guest today has plumbed the details of Twain's old age and emerged with a portrait of the great American novelist that is very different from the conventional one of a man who had grown tired, bitter, and angry. Michael Sheldon is a correspondent for the Daily Telegraph and a critic for the Baltimore Sun. His new book is called Mark Twain, Man in White, The Grand Adventure of His Final Years. Michael, welcome to Think.
It's good to be with you.
Let's talk about your title, Man in White. We distinctly remember him as this old guy with white hair in a white suit, and he would be delighted about that.
It's funny, the folksy image that Mark Twain has, and it's partly built on that image of him in white, but that really dates only from the last 4 years of his life. And it was a deliberate decision on his part, facing, as he knew, probably death in the next few years. He thought he would go out with a bang, with a real splash. And he always loved white suits, but of course it was one thing to wear them in the summer, quite another to wear them all the year round. And he unveiled it, this new look, head to toe in white, at the Library of Congress in 1906. It made people gasp. They were in shock to see someone in December, which is when he wore it, wear white in that fashion.
And what was interesting about that was that he knew that it would make a big splash to wear this in December, and so he was able to get a lot more attention for what might have been sort of a dreary congressional hearing, even with Mark Twain there.
Well, he always had his works illustrated, and he understood the power of images through that, because the original editions of Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn, Connecticut Yankee, they all had gorgeous illustrations in them. And I think he wanted to become the last illustration. He wanted to be the last image of his life and career. And what's uncanny about it is that that image has endured. We still think of Mark Twain always in that signature white suit, but most people don't realize that that was a very conscious creation of those last years of his life.
And in fact, after he made headlines in that, he went home and had his tailor make him up a closet full of these things.
Yeah, he had a whole group of suits made for both summer and winter wear. One day he stood in front of the mirror in one of these suits. Of course, he had that lovely white mane of hair, and he said to the mirror, "Oh, I wish I had a grandfather like that." He was very proud of his look.
There was more to the choice of white than simply wanting to make a splash. He would have worn a black suit, but he was tired of wearing black.
He had had a number of deaths in his family and among his friends in the last few years, and in those days, people went into deep mourning, wore black clothes for months at a time. Sometimes women wore black veils, and he very specifically said, "I've had enough of black." He said, "They remind me of my funerals." So he said, "It'll be white all the year round until I die," and he kept that promise.
How did his public persona tend to differ from his personality behind closed doors with the people he was closest to?
Well, you know, I don't really think there was too much difference. You would have thought that a man who wrote under a pen name and who had this flamboyant image in the culture would be, say, more reserved and private, but actually he was as entertaining in private as he was in public. He was never really off stage. He was a born showman, and I think he always felt, even if he were acting for an audience of one, he still needed to put on a good show for them. And he would put on shows for his friends at private parties, for little girls that he would entertain at their schools. He was always willing to be the showman.
And he was very fond of little girls. Was it the Starfish Club? Is that the...
Angelfish.
Angelfish Club, yeah.
He wanted grandchildren, and both of his two surviving daughters were unlikely probably to give him grandchildren. His older daughter was in her 30s and showed no sign of marrying, at least he thought. Eventually she did marry. And the other daughter, tragically, had epilepsy and suffered from epileptic fits and seizures. And he said, I've reached the grandfather age. He said, if I'm not going to have grandchildren normally, I'll just adopt some. And he didn't mean that in a literal way. He just meant among his friends, if they had grandchildren, he would sort of appropriate them for a day to entertain them. It was all very innocent. And the interesting thing is, because he was so famous, almost everyone who had any contact with him at this time would go and tell people what it was like to be with him. And everyone raved about the experience of being with him, because he treated children like equals, and he treated kings and queens like equals, too.
It's hard to imagine a better surrogate grandfather than Mark Twain.
He was fun. He would teach the little girls how to play pool, which was his favorite game. He would play a pretty mean game of cards. You had to put up with his smoking, though, because he smoked 20 cigars a day.
20 cigars, and these were not fine Cubans that were hand-rolled and delightful to smell.
No, his friends would offer him good cigars, and he would turn them down because he loved these really awful, smelly old cheroots. They were so strong that even one of his butlers said they could kill at 20 feet.
This meeting that he had before Congress was no small thing for Twain. He was there talking about renewal of his copyrights, and he had been notoriously bad with money, so this was important to him in that he knew that his work was still a gold mine.
A lot of people who know copyright law better than I do have said all of our modern laws and copyright really have their origins in Mark Twain's advocacy of a longer period for authors. In his day, it was rather short. Today, it's 75 years after an author's death, the copyrights remain in force. And Mark Twain had a lot to do with that. He literally lobbied for an extension of that period. And so that he would gain everyone's attention, the first time he showed up for one of these big copyright hearings, that's the occasion in 1906 when he unveiled this white suit.
And he had the stature, I mean, everyone, I think, is aware that he was well-known, but he was a superstar in the literary world and simply in popular culture.
So famous that policemen in London, when he went there for an honorary degree at Oxford, while he was in London, policemen would stop traffic so that he could cross the street. He was indulged because of his fame, allowed to go anywhere he wanted, do what he wanted. It was said that he was the richest writer in America, and the rumor was that he was paid a dollar a word. It wasn't quite that much, but he didn't try to deny it because he thought that sounded good. And one day a man wrote to him asking for his autograph and enclosing a dollar. So Mark Twain, taking the rumored rate at the face value, just wrote back, thanks.
$1 for one word.
That's right.
Michael Sheldon is my guest. His new book is called Mark Twain, Man in White, The Grand Adventure of His Final Years. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We'll take a call now and speak with Ron in Cedar Hill. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I have a question for your guest, and it's a personal question about Twain, not a literary question. His wife died. He lost a daughter. I believe she drowned in a bathtub. And then he had another daughter that he had sort of a death grip on her, as I understand it, wouldn't let her date. And, you know, we think of him as a benevolent, grandfatherly type, but he really, you know, had a really strong influence over his daughter, and it wasn't very pleasant. Is that true?
No, not at all true. In fact, that's one of the revelations in my book, is just how wonderful he was as a father, but the problem was his fame. He was so famous that his older daughter resented that. She wanted to be a singer, a classical singer. She had ambitions to be on the stage. She had boyfriends, and she dated a lot, but she was the one who was usually turning down proposals. She turned down two from one man. Twain pretty much kept clear of her. She was in her 30s during the period I write about and was really kind of a law unto herself. Her name was Clara. But the other daughter was Jean. She was younger, had epilepsy. She did die in her bath, but it wasn't because she drowned. She simply had an epileptic seizure and had a weak heart and died of heart failure. A third daughter died of spinal meningitis. So he was tragically unlucky in terms of family deaths, but he had nothing to do with them. In fact, he spent enormous amounts of money and time trying to get Jean, his epileptic daughter, the latest treatment of the time. It's just that not much could be done for her.
And some of his frustration over the ability to do anything for Gene explains his just fury with Mary Baker Eddy. Can you talk about that?
He wanted to believe in spiritual healing. He wanted to believe that there was some life force that you could trigger to reinvigorate someone who was suffering. But Jean was the test case on that because she was a beautiful, vigorous young woman, and suddenly at about 16, she began suffering these fits. He managed to get the leading expert in America in epilepsy, a man who had studied epilepsy in Europe and knew more about it than anybody else, to treat Jean. And he was her doctor right up to the end. But, you know, they had no medicines at the time. They didn't understand the disease. And so he wanted someone to blame. And I think Mary Baker Eddy, the leader of the Christian Science movement, just presented him with a convenient target. It wasn't really about her. He didn't know her. But he would get angry. He had a hot temper. And he wanted someone to focus that temper and anger on, and she got it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Rod in Dallas. Hi, Rod.
Hi. I have visited Mark Twain's home in Hartford, Connecticut, and there at the museum I saw a typesetting machine that Twain invested in. I wonder if you can tell me any more about his interest in the typesetting business and his battle with Mergenthaler Linotype.
Well, that poor typesetting machine that's sitting there in Hartford is, in today's money, about $3 or $4 million worth of junk, because he invested personally, Twain did, $250,000 in that machine, and that was money in 19th century terms. So heaven knows what it would be today. It never worked. It was far too complicated. Twain had this incredible talent for finding the wrong things to invest in. The Washington Post once said, if you want to know what to invest in, find out what Mark Twain is investing in and avoid it. because the typesetting machine was just one of many things he would put his money into and then find out they didn't work. I kind of defend him on this, though, because I think he did invest in one thing that was priceless, and that was the name Mark Twain. When he created that name and that brand, if you will, and all those wonderful books, he really did hit the big bonanza, as he always thought he would.
And for people who haven't heard the story, Mark Twain is a riverboating term.
Great old riverboat term. In the late 1850s, early 1860s, Twain was a riverboat pilot, would take those big three-decker boats out into the middle of the Mississippi and, you know, run them day and night in all kinds of weather. And the main thing was to not get caught on a snag or a sandbar, and you need to gauge the depth. The deckhands would run a line down to see what the depth was. Mark Twain was 2 fathoms, 12 feet, and Twain always used to say that term, which would be called up on, he said, on the still night air, Mark Twain, would make him think, ah, I'm in safe water. So Samuel L. Clemens, when he decided to be a writer after leaving the river, decided to become Mark Twain.
Michael Sheldon is my guest. He's a correspondent for the Daily Telegraph and a critic for the Baltimore Sun. His new book is called Mark Twain, Man in White, The Grand Adventure of His Final Years. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes now available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Michael Sheldon. He's a correspondent for the Daily Telegraph and a critic for the Baltimore Sun. His new book is called Mark Twain, Man in White, The Grand Adventure of His Final Years. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. So, Michael, toward the end of his life, Twain was also being followed around a good deal of the time by the man he had chosen to be his authorized biographer. Can you talk about the sort of relationship that they had?
I think he understood, Twain did, that he was going to be famous for many, many years to come. And he was really, in these last years, putting those final touches on that life. And one part of that was to write an autobiography, and the other part was to authorize a biography. Both of them together, in their manuscript form, come to over 1 million words. So he understood that there was going to be a lot of interest in his life for years and years to come. And the fellow he chose to do his authorized biography, Albert Bigelow Payne, really did have the advantage of being almost a chum, following him around, going to parties with him, watching him at close range to see how he behaved, and at the end, living just down the street from him. So it's a wonderful thing to read a biography now that seems a little out of date, but nevertheless fun because it shows us Mark Twain up close, and I tried to use as much of that as possible to give readers a sense of what it was like to be in Mark Twain's presence.
Now, Payne initially got along well with the woman who was Twain's personal secretary. Her name was Isabel Lyon, and then things started to go awry.
I think you hear this sort of thing a lot with people who are rich and famous. They attract hangers-on, all kinds of people who are interested in exploiting their fame. Twain had this. He trusted people. But once you crossed him, once you did something he didn't approve of or thought you were betraying him, he would turn on you without mercy. And the woman who was serving as his secretary, Isabel Lyon, not only ran afoul of his biographer, she ran afoul of Mark Twain.
Right.
Because he thought she was trying to swindle him. People can argue about whether that's true or not, but I think the only thing that mattered was that Mark Twain thought it was true. And if he thought it was true, there was no arguing him out of that position. And so he did turn on a couple of close associates simply because he thought he could no longer trust them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Pat in Dallas. Hello, Pat.
Hello. I have one book, apparently out of a collection that Mark Twain gave, of all of his collected works. My favorite story is The Stolen White Elephant. But apparently he produced this series of books to make up for his debts or something late in life. I was wondering if our guest could comment upon that. And I'll take my answer off the phone.
Thanks for your call.
Yes, he went completely bankrupt in the middle of the 1890s, lost essentially everything he had. And he was rescued by a Standard Oil millionaire by the name of Henry Rogers. Rogers loved Twain's work, didn't know him, but got to know him, and basically helped him out of all those financial difficulties. And one of the solutions was to put out new editions of his work, to have Twain include a facsimile signature with them, also to go on a lecture tour. He really helped to rescue Twain's finances. And people would say to Twain, well, how can you associate with this man? He's a robber baron. He's one of the Standard Oil Trust. Don't you know, they would say to him, his money is tainted. And Twain's comic response was always, yeah, taint mine and taint yours. So he wouldn't bear any criticism of Henry Rogers. He was thankful that he had been rescued.
How did Twain's politics evolve, particularly over the end of his life?
Well, he always felt, I think, very strongly about certain issues, but when America became, at the turn of the 20th century, really a world power, he was worried that we were getting involved in other people's business, other people's affairs overseas, and he was very strongly against the notion of America as an imperial power, and argued even with Teddy Roosevelt about that. He also didn't care much for the whole sense of a religious revival. He was very skeptical of people who wore their religions on their sleeves. He said about his own background as a Presbyterian, he said, say what you will about Presbyterians, we're not in the habit of going out and massacring our neighbors. So he had a view of religion that it ought to be fairly quiet and well-tempered.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we'll speak with Bryce in Fort Worth. Hi, Bryce.
Hi. Mr. Sheldon, you mentioned a while back about Twain's opposition to Mary Baker Eddy vis-a-vis his daughter and her health problems. And in fact, you just mentioned something about his Presbyterianism, but I was wondering if you could comment a little bit more about his religious beliefs. If he didn't like Christian Scientism, what did he like?
Well,
I'll take my answer up here. Thanks.
It's a great question. I've come to believe that Mark Twain's problem with God was that he thought God was a lesser Mark Twain. He used to argue things like, well, if he had been in charge of creation, he wouldn't have scattered the mountains around. He would have put all the rocks in one place, as he liked to say. A woman came up to him one day and said, oh, how God must love you. And under his breath, as she walked away, he said, I guess she hasn't heard of our strained relations. He very much saw his relationship with God as a personal one, and not in the way that most people think, because he did believe in God. It's just that he didn't approve of God. He didn't think that the way the universe was set up or any of the normal conceptions of the way a deity is supposed to behave went in accordance with his own views. So he's highly critical of not only religion, but of God. And he did specifically set out there the target of God, because with Twain, all criticism always was personal. He had to look at somebody in the eye and argue with them. So he saw God as like another character that he had some sort of beef with.
And he made criticism personal even with very powerful people on this earth. You mentioned Teddy Roosevelt earlier. He also made it a point to criticize the atrocities in the Belgian Congo.
Oh, yes, he was livid about things that really he had no connection to, but he just thought were awful. King Leopold's treatment of the people in the Congo, which was then a Belgian colony, or the Tsar's treatment of peasants. And he wrote stinging rebukes of both Leopold and Tsar Nicholas. And many people around the world were heartened by those attacks because it gave them some courage to also add their voices to those attacks.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll speak next with Brian in Fort Worth. Hey, Brian.
Hi. Could you have your guest comment on the relationship between Mark Twain and Ulysses S. Grant and his role in helping Grant publish his memoirs shortly before his death?
Oh, another great question. You know, when he left the river, Mark Twain, he served briefly in a Missouri state militia. And at that time, Missouri was wavering between joining the Confederacy or staying in the Union. So to make sure they stayed in the Union, a young colonel organized a regiment over in Illinois and came across the river into Missouri to try and put down any hint of rebellion. Mark Twain later learned that that colonel was Ulysses S. Grant, who later, of course, became General Grant in the war. And he always was fond of saying that Grant never caught him, he said, because he learned more about retreating than the man who invented retreating. And that's mostly what Mark Twain did in his 2 weeks. He just kept hiding from this larger Union force. Years later, it was his great honor to be able, when he owned a publishing company, to publish Grant's memoirs and to write out what was then the largest royalty check ever written for $250,000 to Grant's wife, Julia. As you probably know, Grant was dying of cancer at the time he was finishing his memoirs, so the money really went to support Grant's family after his death, but it was one of the great moments in Twain's life that he was able to help the man who at one time helped to save the Union.
Another great moment at the very end of Twain's life was being awarded this honorary degree from Oxford, which would seem for the most famous writer in the world to be sort of a nice thing to have, but not the greatest feather in his cap. But he was so excited about this that he would wear the cap and gown to other places after the ceremony.
He wore it to his when his older daughter finally did marry. He wore it to her wedding, which she was humiliated by that. As I say, they had a kind of rivalry going, and she was so embarrassed that he wore this, but he was so proud of it, he would answer the door wearing his cap and gown. And the reason was very simple, really. He was a fourth grade dropout. I mean, he left school pretty much at the equivalent of fourth or fifth grade and became an apprentice in a printing shop, so he never had that formal education. He was self-educated, brilliantly self-educated, but he knew he was always lacking that degree, and he was immensely heartened when what was at the time clearly the greatest university in the world, the Oxford University, gave him an honorary doctorate. So you can see why he'd be very proud of that.
Who was he writing for?
He used to say the great masters, he said, are like wine. They write for the elite. He said, I'm like water. I write for the masses, and the masses drink water. So he always saw himself writing for the common person. Even when it was a well-educated person, he was trying to aim for their common sympathies, their common instincts, to try and make people see what they had in common with each other. And that's why his greatest work, Huckleberry Finn, is so important, because that runaway slave and that boy on that raft floating down that big river is his great image of what it's like for two people who are so different to find something in common and create a new kind of bond as a result.
Why do you think he insisted at the beginning of that novel that there was no moralistic message to be taken from it, when clearly there is?
Well, at the beginning of one of his books, he announced there will be no weather in this book, because he was very wary of all the novelists who try to hit you over the head with a moral, or who try to create these stormy scenes with so many adjectives. Again, thinking of himself as the plain, humble man, he was trying to say, don't take me too seriously, but if you just take me seriously, that will be enough. And I think that's really what's resulted in his staying power. He didn't overdo it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. My guest is Michael Sheldon, whose new book is called Mark Twain, Man in White, The Grand Adventure of His Final Years. We'll go back to the phones now and speak with Zach in Fort Worth. Hello, Zach.
Hi. I was wondering if the author could commentate on the relationship between Mark Twain and Nikola Tesla.
Oh, boy.
A little bit about it, but it always seemed very interesting. So,
I'll tell you, these are some very good questions. Well, you know, Tesla was a wizard of electronic, early kinds of devices that used electricity in one form or the other. And in my book, I've got this scene in which I wish I had been there. Twain and Tesla are walking down a street in Manhattan discussing some of these grand inventions. Twain was always fascinated by them. And Tesla had this idea that he could create, using electromagnetic waves or some such thing, create a massive weapon that would make war impossible. In other words, one select group of people would be in charge of this weapon, and anyone who tried to start a war would be instantly annihilated. And, of course, this was a pipe dream, but Twain loved these ambitious, crazy ideas. As an author, he was, of course, full of them, and he loved the fact that he could find a scientist like Tesla who had ideas that were far ahead of his time.
The book does read, based on his prestige and the amount of people he was able to meet, like sort of a who's who of the late 19th and early 20th century. You have a beautiful account in here of his meeting with Helen Keller. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yes. Well, you know, everybody kind of troops through this book. Edison, Teddy Roosevelt, the Wright brothers. I mean, it's a pageant of that period, and they're all fascinating. But I really was fascinated by Helen Keller, because I hadn't understood until I did the research that great phrase, the miracle worker, for Helen's teacher, Annie Sullivan, had taught Helen, who was blind and deaf, how to use language. And when William Gibson wrote the play, The Miracle Worker, he used that phrase from Twain. It was Twain who had originally called Annie the miracle worker. He met Helen when she was still in her teens. He was just entirely fascinated by how she had been able to overcome her deafness and blindness. And she had learned to read lips by using her index finger, her middle finger, and her thumb, placing them against the throat, the lips, and the nose, so that she could get the nasal sounds, the breath, and the guttural sounds through the throat. And Twain would sit for an hour at a time with Helen beside him, placing her fingers on his face in that way, so that he could read to her and she could hear, in quotes, what he was saying. I think that moment in which she's so patiently listening and he's so patiently reading is really one of the brightest moments in my story.
By the way, are there any surviving audio recordings of Twain's voice?
Well, there's a movie, believe it or not, about a two-minute movie. Edison sent out a crew to Twain's new house in the woods in Connecticut. This was not the house in Hartford, but a newer one. And they filmed him walking around in his white suit. You can find it online. It's a nice little film. It was used as what we'd call today a trailer for the silent film that Edison was making of The Prince and the Pauper. But Edison also made a wax cylinder of Twain's voice, and that's the great holy grail of Twain studies, if someone can find that. It apparently has disappeared, but people keep raising the possibility it might be uncovered somewhere. I went back through the old Edison archives and found all the documentation on the making of the film, but nothing about the cylinder.
And Twain left behind a lot of writings specifically to be published posthumously. Is that right?
Yes, because he felt he had a lot to say that his own generation would be appalled by his strongest views about God and religion and sex and the way that people treat each other, the cruelty and also the kindness of people. And he thought that only in the future would generations be able to listen to his views and tolerate them. And he was probably right about that. His strongest statements on this didn't come out until the 1940s, 1960s. And when they did set off an explosion of interest in his work because people enjoyed hearing what Mark Twain really thought about some of his contemporaries and also about some of these big subjects.
Michael Sheldon is with us. His new book is called Mark Twain, Man in White, The Grand Adventure of His Final Years. We'll resume the conversation in a moment and read your emails to think@kera.org, as well as taking your calls to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes now available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Michael Sheldon is my guest. He's a correspondent for the Daily Telegraph and critic for the Baltimore Sun. His new book is called Mark Twain, Man in White, The Grand Adventure of His Final Years. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Paul in Dallas wants to know how much of Letters from the Earth are really from Mark Twain.
Oh, all of them. And that was one of the collections of manuscripts not published until well after his death. In fact, his daughter, Clara, was a bit worried about those, that they would be too scandalous. He talks in there a lot about some of his notions of how people are hypocritical about sex and how they ought to be a lot more honest about their sexual relations. And she thought that would damage his reputation as a children's author. Of course, he never was really a children's author. It's just that when you're a child and you read Tom Sawyer or Huck Finn, you read one kind of book. When you're an adult and you go back to that book, you see a lot more.
Mm-hmm. He was very devoted to his wife, Livy. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
He was. She was the great love of his life. He married her in about 1870, and they had a 34-year marriage. She died of heart failure in 1904. And it was in the aftermath of her death that he pretty much decided he would never put on black again if he could help it. Her death was a great blow to him, and it was only 2 years after her death that he came up with the idea of wearing the white suit all the year round.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Deborah in Mesquite. Hi, Deborah.
Hello. For me, just listening to this author talk and the concepts and the visuals, I think this would make a great masterpiece theater subject matter, and I'd hope someday they might consider doing that.
Well, I'm flattered by your suggestion. Actually, we're in discussions with a couple of people about this because in many ways this story of his life, because it really hasn't been told before, I tried to treat it as though you'd walked in at this great moment where he was the most famous man on earth, and you could follow along in his footsteps while he himself was trying to go out like the showman that he was. The story even ends with a comet streaking across the sky. And that almost seems to me too dramatic to be true, but it was.
Yeah, let's tell that story, because he was born when Halley's Comet was making its brightest appearance in recorded history.
Well, he was. He was born in 1835 when the comet had come around, and he, toward the last year or two of his life, he said, well, if I'm going to die, he said, it'll probably be when the comet comes around again. It comes around every 75 years. And no one took this very seriously, but even after his death, when people do know it did come around again in 1910, there's always been this notion that it was just vaguely out there in the sky somewhere. And I thought, knowing Mark Twain as I'd come to know him, that it was probably right there in the sky the night he died. So I looked around as hard as I could for some evidence of that fact, and what I stumbled across shocked me. The Harvard College Observatory, which had the strongest telescope in America at the time, had been tracking the comet. And on the night that Mark Twain died, they came out of the observatory, the scientists working there, and stood outside in wonder and looked up and saw the comet with the naked eye for the first time and actually made their observations. They recorded the length of its tail and all sorts of things because they were stunned to see that it was there in the sky, visible without the telescope. I thought that was amazing.
What a great discovery to make.
Yeah, I'd come to know Twain, I thought he probably wasn't kidding. He didn't tend to kid.
He really was quite a showman.
About those things, no, he was quite serious.
Tell me this. Why do so many people think of the end of Twain's life as this really bitter, sort of dyspeptic time?
Because he was, as one of his daughters says, he could be the lily of the valley one moment and a volcano the next. He did have this temper, and when he was full of anger, he would really pour it out in ways that if you didn't know him, you would take far too seriously. He never broke a smile when he told jokes, and he also didn't indicate that he was slightly joking when he was serious. You could only tell from the twinkle in his eye what he really felt. And he would overpower people sometimes when he was so angry. And I came to realize that a lot of his anger was kind of a passing storm. He would get very angry and then the next moment be as sweet and gentle as I think his nature really was. He was a very resilient man. He was a frontier character and had that ability to come back from blows and from misfortunes. And I think that's been underestimated.
Obviously, he was able, as a very young person, to sort of witness the scourge of slavery. Did he have black friends in his adult life?
He sure did. In fact, he helped one black student get through Yale Law School. He helped pay his tuition. He was very concerned about helping blacks to become a part of American society where they didn't feel alienated in any way. And he understood, I think, more than most people, that in many ways African Americans were as much a part of American history as anyone. They had helped to build the country. And growing up in Missouri, he had seen that. It's just that as a boy, he didn't understand slavery as well as in later years he could look back and see just how incredibly evil it had been.
I want to talk a little bit more about his relationship with his daughter, Clara. You mentioned that she had musical aspirations. Do you have evidence that she had a particular amount of talent?
You get mixed reviews on that. In fact, the critics were mixed. Some would say that her voice was okay. Others made fun of it. Probably she was a second-rate talent, which is no small thing in that world of really amazing first-rate talents. But it wasn't good enough to be as famous as her father was. So she would complain that whenever she went on stage to sing, that people were judging her as Mark Twain's daughter. And she kept using that phrase over and over again, that she didn't want to be considered Mark Twain's daughter. There was nothing Mark Twain could do about that, of course. He was Mark Twain. But his daughter found it hard to launch a career in his shadow.
And his daughter Jean, who died as a young woman, actually shared some of his affinity for words and literary abilities.
I came to adore Jean. She's been so misunderstood, people would dismiss her as the daughter Mark Twain wanted to forget. No, he was devoted to her and so heartbroken that there was nothing that could be done about her epilepsy. And he knew what her real talents were. She spoke Italian fluently. She could speak French. She could read in those languages. She was a very bright woman. She wrote letters to the New York Times that got published on various issues that she cared a lot about. It's just that the epilepsy was so misunderstood at the time, it was often associated with insanity. Hmm. And Twain struggled against that when people wanted to assume that his daughter was somehow insane. And he wanted to emphasize to them, no, no, that's not at all true. Jean's a wonderful person. And when she died, it's really a heartbreaking moment in the book because she dies at home. He's finally managed to get her at home and get some care for her there. And tragically, the housekeeper at his home comes in one morning and says, "Oh, come, Mr. Clemens, Jean's dead." Hmm. And he has to go in and see her lifeless body. She's only 29 years old.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Brad in Mansfield. Hello, Brad.
Hi. I was wondering, he said earlier about the weathering the storm and how Mark Twain would be very angry one moment and calm the next. Is there any evidence that Mark Twain might have been bipolar? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I don't know that it was something that anyone could diagnose. It's just that he was a character of the frontier. He did work on steamboats, and those characters out there had explosive tempers. It was a tough business. You didn't put up with much if you didn't have to. When he was a steamboat pilot, by the way, his authority was supreme. Once the steamboat left the bank, by law, the steamboat pilot's commands could not be ignored. So he used to say, I spent 4 years being absolutely obeyed. So he said, I still like that. I like for people to jump when I give a command. That steamboat period did have an enormous influence on his whole life.
Interestingly, he writes about periodic bouts of depression and characterizes them as a disease, although he means it certainly more in a figurative sense than in the literal way that we write about it now. But how significant a factor was depression in his later life?
He said it would come over him from time to time, but then he would throw it off. And I think there's great proof that he could do this because he would be very depressed, say, late at night, but he would say, once I wake up in the morning and I look at myself in the mirror and have shaved, he said, I'm ready to look for trouble again. And he was very fond of using that term, trouble. You know, when he first started giving lectures, they would advertise the lectures as, the trouble begins at 8. And I've always liked that notion that you could show up at 8 o'clock at a Mark Twain lecture and never know what was going to happen.
How do you think he saw himself?
I think he was enormously proud of himself. He knew he had accomplished things that very few people had. After he died, one of his friends referred to him as the Lincoln of our literature. And it's interesting because they grew up about 150 miles apart, Lincoln just across the river in Springfield, Illinois, and Twain over in Hannibal. And they did have a lot in common, both self-educated, both very principled people, both people who had a sense of their own destiny. It's just that Mark Twain had this very long life in which he could ponder on what he called the fairy tale of my life. He did think that there had been some sort of destiny he was going to reach. And when that comet went across the sky, I think he felt that was the signature ending that he deserved.
And Twain certainly loved to travel and even lived abroad for a period of time.
Loved other cultures. A lot of people don't realize that he spoke German fairly well. In fact, he once gave a lecture in Vienna, the beginning of which he read out in German, and Sigmund Freud, of all people, was in the audience and later complimented him on his German. And that's the amazing thing about Mark Twain's life. It's It's full of these unexpected surprises that we think we know Mark Twain, but unless you look pretty closely, you probably don't.
It does seem that he probably didn't spend nearly as much time reclining in a rocking chair as we imagine.
No, he was always busy. In fact, one of his friends said that he was still taking stairs three at a time, even in the last year of his life. He remained very slender. He was about 155 pounds, was about 5'9". I love to say that I've got the Mark Twain diet down now. I wouldn't try it, but if you want to stay in good shape, at least until you die of a heart attack, his formulation was a piece of apple pie and cold milk for breakfast, normal dinner, no lunch, and then, of course, 20 cigars.
I'm going to make sure that everyone knows that's your prescription.
Yeah, not mine. I wouldn't want to claim it, actually, but that's what Mark Twain, that's really the reason why he stayed slender.
What was his health like at the very end? When he was just about to die, he recognized this, but he had been, for the most part, sort of hale and hearty until the end.
He had, and then those last few months, the angina began to act up. He said he called it a tobacco heart. He realized that all that smoking had finally caught up with him, and the doctors told him he had to stop. And he said, well, I don't care for death, but I do care for smoking, so I'll continue smoking. And that really is what killed him. Even though he was able in the last few weeks to cut it down to 4 cigars a day.
But he was very insistent that he wanted to die at home and not, he'd been visiting friends for an extended period.
He went down to Bermuda. He fell in love with Bermuda. For one thing, he said, it's the only place where I can look logical in white. because it's this place built out of coral, and it's a lovely place with lots of white buildings, and also even some of the old roads there were white, because they were created out of the coral. And so he loved to parade around there in his suit. But in the last few days of his life, he realized he was probably not going to make it much longer. And I think he used to say, some people can see a comet coming. He said, I hear it. And he felt he needed to get home to fulfill that last final show. And so literally 6 days before he died, he took the boat that would take him back to New York and then to his home in Connecticut, and that's where he died.
Given that probably everyone listening has read The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer, what other work of Twain's should people discover if they haven't read it yet?
You may have sensed from my comments, I'm very, very fascinated by his period on the Mississippi, not just as a writer of fiction, but somebody who lived that river life. And one of my favorites is Life on the Mississippi.
Thank you for the recommendation. Michael Sheldon is a correspondent for the Daily Telegraph and a critic for the Baltimore Sun. His new book is called Mark Twain, Man in White, The Grand Adventure of His Final Years. Michael, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.